Thank you.
Well, good evening. How are you guys tonight? All right, this is going to be interaction. We're going to talk a lot together. If you need a handout, please raise your hand. We will get you those promptly. If you need one, you'll need one if you don't have one. I want to make a few preliminary remarks before we begin. First, thank you to the group who invited me here this weekend. Thank you for the invitation to come and share. We're going to have a good time. Number two, if you were raised in a Christian home this evening, some of the things that I'm going to be sharing may be a little bit challenging for you. If you were not raised in a traditional Christian home, you're actually at an advantage this evening. You're on easy street. The rest of you, I'm sure it will produce some questions, and we'll take time either this evening and tomorrow, tomorrow to look at some of those. I want to be very clear tonight's topic. The title is Why Think This Is True. This is not an apologetic or a defense of the Christian religion. I want to be very clear, I do not claim to be a Christian. I do claim, or try to, be a follower of the person Jesus Christ. But the Christian religion, the more I understand what it's becoming associated with today, Jesus Christ historically was not just a unique human being. How many would agree he was a unique human being? How many would agree with that? He was also very unique to the modern Western Americanized version of Christianity that exists today. How many would agree with that this evening? He was very unique to the religion today that claims his name. And so I want to make sure you understand, we say, well, I think this is true. This is not the Christian religion. I contend that it's not about a religion, it's about a person. And that's what we're talking about this evening. I want to also be clear that this is not an apologetic or a defense of a holy text, a scripture, the Bible. It is not a defense of biblical inerrancy. We could debate all that later. I would just like to remind us in the beginning that what we're talking about this evening, the first century followers of Jesus were called Christians. They weren't called Bibleans. Do you understand the difference? They weren't called Scripturans. In other words, if I could diagram what I'm trying to explain to you this evening, you can write this in the gray section on your notes there on the back of your handout. Put some concentric circles there on your paper. Draw this with me so that you can take it home. Nowadays within the Christian religion, what many Christians do is they put at the very center of everything they're about, the Bible. How many have noticed that happening? Everything's based on the scriptures. Everything's just about the Bible. And the Bible's used to prove everything. And there's a big debate over whether the Bible's inerrant, whether it's inspired. And that's not what tonight is about. But I want to explain to you what can happen if that's what takes place. Pretty soon, what determines whether you're part of a community, welcomed in a community, or excluded from a community is whether or not you agree with that community's opinion about what that book teaches. How many have ever seen that happen before? You're in or out, dependent upon your opinion about biblical beliefs. And what happens in those type of scenarios is that you're only given value and belonging if you agree with this. Now, once again, we can debate this later. If you're raised in a Christian home, this may be a little challenging for you. But tonight is not a defense of the scriptures at all. In the center of these concentric circles is rather a person. The historical person of Jesus Christ. We're going to be looking at the canonical gospels, the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And we're not going to be treating them as the inspired word of God. We're just looking at them as the historical documents that they are, that claim, their claim is that they're reporting reliable history. And we need to intellectually assess that. Without dismissing honesty, we need to look at that claim with an open mind and see whether or not the evidence tends in that direction or tends away from it. Once again, for those of you who are traditional Christians tonight, please don't freak out and leave. I'm not throwing out the Bible. Okay, I do still believe that Jesus gave the scriptures authority in his life. I believe that he interpreted them very differently than modern Christianity interprets them. The Bible I would put out here somewhere. Notice it's not at the center. What's at the center, a book or a person? Yes. A book or a religion or a person? A person. Outside of this, you could talk about dogma. You know, what the Christian religion, all of the different denominations agree on. Outside of that, you could talk about doctrine. And all of that's good. It's on the screen. We can debate that some other time, some other weekend. I'm sure it would be a lovely conversation. What we're talking about tonight is not all the periphery. There really is only one basket that all our eggs are to be in. As a follower of Jesus, it's not necessarily about what everyone's opinion is about that outer stuff. When that becomes the emphasis, you find people who claim to be following a person, but are more concerned about being right than anything else. How many have ever seen that happen before? I'm right, you're wrong, you've got to agree with me. And that's what makes people who claim to be following Jesus or Christians, that's really what makes Christians jerks. How many have ever bumped into that phenomenon? Okay, so we want to steer clear of that. Please understand, I am not defending Christianity tonight by any means. There's been more bloodshed in the name of Jesus Christ by the Christian religion than any other religion in human history. It will go down, most likely, as the most violent religion in human history. G.K. Chesterton. How many have ever read anything by G.K. Chesterton here? Anybody? 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 Okay, good. G.K. Chesterton is known for this statement that the history of Christianity doesn't prove that the teachings of Jesus have been tried and found wanting. The history of Christianity proves that the teachings of Jesus have been found difficult and left untried. There's a grave difference between the history of Christianity and the person of Jesus, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But let's begin here with just that. Which light was it? Which button was it? Victoria, could you come up here and do this for me? Thank you. I am so technologically dense. Something else I want to share is that the whole gender issue this evening. I do use male personal pronouns for God. And I want to explain to you where I'm coming from. I do that with deep regret, and I also do it with conviction. I do not believe God is male. Any women thankful for that? Anybody? Anybody? I do not believe God is male, nor do I believe God is female. I believe in Genesis, and whether you believe it's literal or just a story, I don't care this evening. In the story, the narrative of Genesis, when God created, He made mankind in His image, and that included both male and female. Okay? The problem is, and this is my regret, within any language, whether it's Greek, Hebrew, or English, there is no personal pronoun that is both gender inclusive. The only pronoun we have is not inclusive, but exclusive. And what pronoun is that? What personal pronoun is that, English students? It. And that's my conviction part. I have to use a personal pronoun. It has to be male out of regret. But I have to use a personal pronoun out of conviction because I believe that the God revealed through Jesus Christ is not an impersonal entity. He's not an it. He's a genuine person that exists out there. And that's what I want to talk about. So I want you to understand where I'm coming from. When I use he or father or him, it's with two emotions this evening. It's with deep regret that we don't have a better way to communicate it. But it's also with conviction that we don't need to go so far that we ignore that he is a person. And if we can come up with a better option, I think we should be pursuing that all the time. Tonight, let's begin. Let's begin with the undisputable facts. You can get these from Pliny, Tacitus. How many like Tacitus? How many stay up late on a Friday night reading Tacitus? One of you. Good, I'm impressed. You're the first hand that's ever been raised in one of these lectures. You actually enjoy Tacitus. We would get along. I don't know you, but I like you. We would get along very well. Pliny, Tacitus, Josephus. I'm going to admit in front of everybody, Josephus is corrupted. How many know that this evening? Josephus is corrupted. What I'm going to be referring to this evening is the undisputable parts of Josephus that everybody, secular and Christian alike, agree is uncorrupted. All right? All of these sources agree that sometime in the 3rd to 1st century, 30s, 40s, or 50s, there was a band of Jewish men. How many of them? Talk to me. Not 12, because one of them was dead. So, how many? 12 minus 1, simple math. Tell me this is a university. How many? 11. Okay, there was a band of 11 Jewish men that went around the countryside, and starting in Palestine and expanding out into the Jewish empire. There was this group of Jewish men that were telling a story about a contemporary, that's important, a contemporary Jewish carpenter. These fundamental Orthodox Palestinian Jewish men were going against their most fundamental Jewish convictions and claiming that this contemporary Jewish carpenter of theirs was the Yahweh, the Jehovah of the Old Testament. It was God on earth in human flesh, and that he should be worshipped. They claimed that he did miracles. And that's something that we're going to talk about in a moment as well. The postmodern naturalistic worldview at least needs to consider this. That even the enemies of Jesus during that time agreed that the miraculous things Jesus did were not mythological. They weren't legend. They weren't exaggerations. Even the enemies of Jesus claimed that Jesus did the miraculous. They just said that he did it by the power of the devil rather than of God. But did they say that the miracles were an exaggeration? Talk to me. Did they say that? Okay, so these Jewish men claimed that Jesus did some supernatural stuff. And the kicker, which I know is difficult to believe, trust me, is that they believed this Jewish man had actually died on a Roman cross and had come back to life. Now, I once again know that that's very difficult. What I want to ask this evening is the question, do you have to commit intellectual suicide in a postmodern naturalistic world? Do you have to commit intellectual suicide to possess a genuine faith in this story? Let's define faith for a moment, or belief. Let's define rational or irrational belief. A rational belief. I got on a plane today to come here. That takes belief. That takes faith. How many would agree with that? That takes some level of faith. I have to believe three things. I have to believe that the pilot is competent and sober. I have to believe that the mechanics have done their duty. I have to believe, and this is the hardest one for me because I'm in West Virginia and I know all these guys because it's a local small town, that TSA has actually done their job. Now, I don't have any way to prove this unequivocally. I don't have exhaustive evidence to prove any of these beyond a shadow of a doubt. I do have some evidence. And I look at the evidence that I do have, and I look at the trajectory that that evidence is pointing us in. If that evidence is pointing me in the conclusion of these three beliefs, we would say that that belief is rational. Say that word with me this evening. Rational. Say it again. Rational. What is irrational faith? And this is what many who do have a faith in Jesus are accused of having. Irrational faith is when you look at the evidence. Let's say I get on the plane and the pilot stumbles into the cockpit with a fifth of Jack Daniels. Let's say there are little dudes running away from the airplane with remote controls, and I see behind them that they've just attached little red blinking lights to the wings, and there's pieces of the plane actually even falling off. Okay, there's my evidence. If at this point I believe that the pilot is competent and sober, that the mechanics have done their job, and there are no terrorists involved, that TSA is on top of it all, if, for me to believe that at this point, looking at the evidence, is that belief rational or irrational? Irrational belief is when you look at the evidence, but you believe something contrary to the evidence that we have. We cannot scientifically, theologically, philosophically prove beyond a shadow of a doubt the existence of God. How many would be willing to at least admit that tonight? Let's be honest. You can't unequivocally do it. But when we look at the evidence that we do have this evening, I'm just simply asking you to believe in a God. It's still faith. Believing that he's out there and that he looks like Jesus, is that rational or is that irrational? That's the only question we need to answer tonight. What kind of a belief is that? Let's look at it. You only got three options. Number one, why did these 11 Jewish men, why did they go out through the countryside telling this story? Option number one is that it's actually true. That is an option. How many would agree with that? That's an option, viable option. Another option, another theory that's out there, is that these 11 Jewish men revered Jesus, much like those who followed Buddha, and they wanted to do something in honor of Jesus, because he was such a great man, that out of love for Jesus, they wanted to create a religion in his name. And so they actually created this whole Christ legend, this whole Christ movement, just to honor Jesus. In other words, in all honesty, when you look at that, what you're really accusing them of doing is what?
Fraud.
What's that?
Fraud.
Fraud. Or another thing, where I come from, we don't use such big words, Tim, but I like it. We drop off a couple, we just stick to like three letters at a time. What would we call this? A lie. It's fraud. It's fraud. Yes. But we call it a lie. So that's option number two, that the reason they did this is because they were lying. Right, right, right. You're right. You're right. You're right. But you invited me, so you're stuck with it. I take great courage that even Einstein spoke in this room tonight. So. The third option is that these men genuinely believed what they were communicating was true, but it had become exaggerated, and it was something of a legendary nature. Now, you have these three theories. Number one, that it's true. The second one is called the lie theory. What's it called? The third one is called the legendary theory. What is it called?
Legendary.
And that's what we need to look at. Which one of these three theories, as difficult as all three of them are, which one is the most probable? Which one is the most rational? How many would agree that the first one, to believe, because I've never met a dude that died and came back to life. How many would agree that option number one is at least difficult? How many would agree with that? To believe in the supernatural and the miraculous. It's at least difficult. The other options aren't easier. And this is what I want to share this evening. They're not, when you look at the evidence, it doesn't get easier, it gets harder. The question, first question you have to ask yourself with the lie theory, if you're going to go into a court of law and accuse someone of having doing something, what's the first thing that law, that court is going to ask you for? Not just evidence, no, no. Yes, they're going to ask you for evidence, but the very first thing they're going to ask you for is, not witnesses even, motive. They're going to ask for motive, that's right. Motive. Why would they do this? Now, let's talk about this for a moment. If the disciples were like the TV evangelists today, getting rich off this Jesus story, would they have a big Rolls Royce, big diamond, white suit, never mind. Would they have a motive for making, telling a story? Okay. Is this what undisputable history, are you with me now? Everybody agrees with this. Is that the way history says it happens? Tacitus? A Roman historian living in the time of Nero actually felt sorry for, even by Roman standards, the barbaric way in which Christians were treated by Nero. You see, telling this story didn't get them anything. Actually, the opposite happened. What happened to these 11 men for telling this story? And it didn't begin in Rome. It began in, yeah, all of them except for one. And they tried and they couldn't, according to tradition. All of them were murdered for this story. They lost their lives. And not just that, they watched their spouses lose their lives. Christian tradition states that Peter's wife was actually crucified alongside of him. And they watched their children be put to death, fed to lions. So here's my question. Where's your motive? If you're going to say they were lying, you need to answer that question. Where's the motive? That's the first problem that the lie theory has. Once again, it started in Jerusalem in the beginning. These men knew that, forget Rome for a moment, just within first century Orthodox, monotheistic, Palestinian Judaism. Just within that context alone, if you went out claiming that some human being was God, what happens in that context? What's the result? They had laws for that. What would happen? You'd be stoned. This is death. They knew this was going to be the result. The second question you have to ask is, could they have pulled this off? You see, this isn't something that happened long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away. This is something that happened right here in Princeton last year. And we'll talk about that in a moment. This is something that happened right here. See, in Paul's earliest account of the Jesus story, Even secular scholars agree was written in the early 50s. That's the earliest account we have. But in that account, Paul is sharing where he got this from, and that was from his visit to Jerusalem, which was passed on to him, he says in Corinthians. That which was given to him, he passed on to the Corinthians. It was given to him, all scholars agree, it was given to him on his first trip to Jerusalem, which happened within 2 or 3 years of the event itself. That Jesus died and came back to life, 1 Corinthians 15, and that 500 people saw it all at the same time, most of whom, when Paul said, when he wrote this, most of whom were still living. He's passing down to them this established creedal material that is within 2 or 3 years of the actual historic event. So, here's my question. Forget 2 or 3 years. Just 20 years. Say 20 years. Could it have been easily falsifiable? In other words, you mentioned people like Pilate. Who was Pilate? He was the governor. You guys have a governor around here somewhere? What about Ananias? Who was that? Not Ananias. Yes, that's not the one I'm looking for. Arimathea is an A. I knew. Joseph. Arimathea. Who was he? Remember the saying? That was the equivalent of their U.S. Supreme Court. These are big names. Are you with me? Yes, he mentions Caiaphas. These are big dudes that are still living that you could have gone around. Big names that are local here. And they could have walked to, because that's all they had there, of course. They could have walked to and talked, did this really happen? If it was easily false, if they were making it up, could you have easily gone around and done the research and found out they were just lying? Could you have done that? How much evidence do we have that the disciples were lying about this? I'm not talking about legend. I'm saying bold-faced lying, fraudulent. How much evidence do we have? Here's the big problem. How much evidence do you have? Talk to me. You have absolutely none. It's a great theory. But theories and hypotheses rise and fall based on what? Evidence. It's a great theory that they were lying. Your problem is you got no motive. And you got no evidence. And the evidence could have been easily produced if it was there. A lot of things were said about those 11 men in the first century. But we have no record of anyone at any time accusing them of having lied about this story. You see, and here's the third one. What's number three say? Dude, if I saw my wife and kid dying over a story that I made up, I don't care how much I love Jesus. I made the story up. Are you with me? What are you going to do? You answer me that. What are you going to do? Talk to me. You'll fess up. That's right. How many know anything about early Mormonism? Anybody know anything about early Mormonism? Anybody ever studied the history of Mormonism? Everything in Mormonism is established with the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses. There were three witnesses in the very beginning that claimed to have seen the angel Moroni give the golden tablets to Joseph Smith. Okay, when they started migrating west, they got to the Missouri area, and Missourians didn't take too kindly to having more than one wife, and by then they were practicing polygamy. So the persecution of the Mormons became rather intense. When the persecution heated up, guess how many of those original three said, maybe we didn't see that angel give those tablets. Guess how many of those original three did that? Not all three. 2 out of the 3. How many know the history of Watergate? Anybody taking American history yet? Simple high school American history class? Yeah, it's Watergate. How long was that lie able to be kept together? We're talking 2 weeks, all right? And one of them, James Dean, for 2 weeks, only 2 weeks could he keep his mouth shut. And I would like to remind you that nobody's spouse's lives were on the line. Nobody's personal lives were on the line. All they were facing was possible imprisonment and a lot of embarrassment. And how long could they keep it together? You're telling me 11 men made up this story, and history plays out with the level of persecution that it does. And they don't back down. They don't desert. They, whatever you say about the disciples, you have to agree with at least this. They believed sincerely. They saw what they claimed to have seen. And they were willing to die for it. That's significant for me. Is there anyone else here that resonates with? That's significant. And here's the fourth one, and it's kind of more comical, but it's true nonetheless. Why is there, if it's a lie, why is there culturally counterproductive, cultural contradictions in the story? If it's true, here's one of them. Women, according to first century Jewish standards, were property. Who's the first person to find, who's the star witness? Who's the first person to find the risen Lord? A woman? Who's the first one to proclaim the message of a risen Lord? It seems to me that if you're making this story up and you're trying to give it some clout, in that culture, how many think that just according to first century standards, Jesus' treatment of women alone is breathtaking? How many feel that way? You see, he allows Mary to sit at his feet, which was a place that only potential rabbis were able to sit at. And that was a position only reserved for men. And yet when Martha came out and said, listen, you should put her in her place. I am in here doing the custodial duties all by myself. It wasn't just, you've left me alone. It was, you are letting her have a social position that is not acceptable. And what did Jesus say? Leave her alone. She's doing what's good. I think that's breathtaking. Anyone else with me? Anybody else with me? That's breathtaking. Now here's the kicker. I'm just submitting to you that if 11 men made this story up, think about it. Once again, who's the first one to find a risen Lord, man or woman? Who's the first one to proclaim a risen Lord, man or woman? According to the story, why? Where are the men? Why are they hiding? Because they're cowards! I'm just telling you, if 11 Jewish men were making this up, it wouldn't read like that. You've got to at least answer these questions. When you look at the evidence, I don't think the evidence is pointing with the trajectory that they were lying. If you agree with that so far tonight, let me see your hands. Does that make sense to you? It doesn't look like they were lying. Matter of fact, this is why most scholars today, even secular scholars, do not buy the lie theory. There really is only one of two educated theories out there. Number one is the first one, that it is actually true. And the second one is that the disciples were very sincere. They were just themselves overtaken by this. It was a legend. It was an exaggeration. It was a something of a mythological nature, an exaggerated story. But let's look at that for a moment. Take out your handout of legends and lore. Flip to that one for a moment. And how much time do we have left? Boy, we could talk all night. Oh, we got a half an hour. We can do this. Okay, legendary theory. Let's look at it honestly in the culture and context in which you're saying this legend found fertile soil, got off the ground, and grew into the Christian religion within the first century. How do Orthodox, once again, monotheistic, Jewish men go against their most fundamental convictions within their own, what's that say? And begin to worship a contemporary Jewish person as the embodiment of Yahweh on earth? How do they do it? Maybe you don't understand this. If we went to a third world country that was very superstitious and had all these legends and myths, would it be very easy or hard for me to convince them that I was God? I'm white. Some of them never seen a white person before. They'd at least think I'm odd just to begin with, would they not? Think about it, wouldn't they? So I show up and I look different than them. Would it be easy or hard for me to convince them that I was a divine being come to earth? Easy or hard? Very easy. Very easy. Is their culture prone to a legend like this? Or is it antagonistic to a legend like this? All right, well, you know, if they'll believe it, I'm sure you guys would, right? Herb Montgomery, I'm God. How many buy that tonight? Why do you find it so much more difficult when they didn't? Talk to me. Because you live in a very different culture. Yeah, you do, Tim. Yes, yes, and I will agree with that for sure. You belong to a culture that is very resistant to anything that even hints of something like that. What you have to understand is that first century Jewish Palestine, maybe not the surrounding regions, but Palestine, was even more resistant to legends and myths than America is today. They were surrounded by what culture? Talk to me, historically. Any historians here? What culture were they surrounded by? The Roman Empire, but what culture? Paganism, yes. Talk to me. Really? Greek? The Hellenistic culture? Okay. Now, within Hellenism, were they used to making divine beings human? Were they used to making humans divine beings? Yes, and were they used to saying that beings had died and come back to life? Could they have done that? Yes. Now tell me, first century Jewish Orthodox men, were they prone to buy that? Or did they have certain safeguards to protect them from stories like this? We talked about it a moment ago. You even breathe that one of your contemporaries is God. What's the penalty? They didn't mess around. What's the penalty? That's not a fine. Are you with me? That's not a punishment. That's not imprisonment. That is life over. That's serious. They looked at all of these legends and myths and pagan cultures that they were surrounded by, and they saw these things as hooey, and they had certain safeguards in place to protect. They were not going to believe it unless it was in the Old Testament scriptures. They were more within Palestine now. And archaeology even backs this up. It sounds weird, okay? But within archaeology today, we're finding in Palestine really simple evidences of how Orthodox they were. They had the purification jars, something that had disappeared in other areas of Judaism. The purification jars were things used strictly by the religious conservative of their day. You also find within Palestine, you find zero, during that strata, that era, you find zero pig bones. What does that tell you? What does that tell you? They weren't having Sunday afternoon barbecue. Are you with me? Now, in the other outlying areas, they might have been, but not in Palestine, where this story began. How does the legendary theory, please explain to me, how a legend like the Jesus story finds fertile soil and even gets off the ground in Palestine? That's the first problem you've got to answer. Number two, how do these men go from Orthodox Jewish men to contradicting their most fundamental Jewish convictions? How do they do that overnight? I remember taking a class once where my professor said to me, Buddha was an atheist. Tell me who the great Gautama Buddha is. Anybody here know? If you don't, go to the local Chinese restaurant. He's the fat guy on the counter. That's Buddha, okay? The great Gautama Buddha himself was an atheist. But he was given divine status by his followers who revered him so much. And my professor asked, well, is it so hard to believe that this atheist could be made and turned into a god in Buddhism? Is it so hard to believe that these Jewish men could have done the same? And at face value, first glance, that looks pretty similar. But here's the problem. When you're talking about Buddha and Jesus, you're not dealing with apples and apples. You're not dealing with apples and bananas. You're not dealing with apples and even aardvarks. Are you with me? It's totally two different things. And I'll tell you why I believe that. Number one, the culture in which Buddha became divine. Were they used to turning people into gods or opposed to it? Talk to me. Used to it. How about Judaism? Used to it or opposed to it? Opposed to it. All right. So you've got one culture that's opposed, one culture that's used to it, very pro. Here's your other problem. Within the culture that Buddha became God, that was not a monotheistic culture, that was a polytheistic culture. What does that mean? They believed in many gods. If you're claiming Buddha was God, he's not the God, he's just a God. In monotheistic Palestine, to claim that some dude was God is not a God. This is the God, the lawgiver, the creator God, the Old Testament, the dude Moses saw face to face. This is God. Nothing could be more offensive to a first century Jew. Do you understand? Totally different cultures. And here's the kicker. How many years, and it only happened in one sect of Buddhism even, but how many years did it take in that culture that was favorable to it? How many years did it take for Buddha to arrive at divine status? Does anyone know? Took 500 years. With the story of Jesus, you don't have 500 years. You don't have 50 years. I can make a pretty convincing argument that all the books of the New Testament were written within the first century by 100 AD. I actually can make a convincing argument that it was by 70 AD, all of them, but we won't get into that either. But let's just be liberal. Let's say it took them 70. You don't have 500 years. With Paul, you don't even have 50 years. And if what Paul is saying has any validity to it, you don't even have 5 years. Jesus comes out of the chute overnight from the very beginning, fully divine. He doesn't grow into that. He is fully divine in the very beginning in these stories. You got to wrestle with that. How does this happen, not only in this culture, how does it happen without the time it requires? All legends. How do legends develop? Talk to me. How do they develop? Over time, but how? Yeah, it had to be passed on, told and retold. And here's another problem you've got. This story was being told during those first 20 or 30 or 40 years. Say, let's be liberal, 70 years. These stories are being told not post-Gutenberg. Do you know what I mean by that? They weren't written down. These stories were being told in an oral culture, a culture of oral tradition. And that, to us, sounds very subjective. But stenographers today have discovered incredible evidence and research that when you look at oral tradition cultures, the way in which these histories were passed down, it wasn't like, here, this is what happened to us once upon a time as you're walking down the street to another dude. The way that they told their histories was in a group like this. You had old people, you had young people. The young people might be hearing it for the very first time. The older people, they've heard it umpteen times, every year of their life. You had an orator, and this guy would speak, and he was able to take the story and mix up the chronology of it. Are you with me? He could even differ in some minor details. But when it came to the single most important elements of the story, he was not allowed to diverge. Because if he ever started to exaggerate or it became legend, what would the older people do? Talk to me. High level of accountability. They would rein him back in. What stenographers are able to prove conclusively is that histories within oral traditions can go for centuries. How long? And not change by one detail. How many think that's astounding? Because of the way in which they are communicated. You've got the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, being written within 20 to 50 years within a community that was tightly knit, tightly woven, that was a community of oral tradition historical repeaters. They were passing on this story in groups. High level of accountability. How many think that alone is astounding? That when you look at the history, that's at least something you have to ponder. So here's the challenge. You don't have enough time. You don't have the right culture. Something else legends need is a cultural catalyst. Why does the legend of King Arthur exist? Why is anybody here know that legend? Did we know King Arthur? Anybody know that? Anybody here? Okay. Why? Why did it come to? What produced it? Talk to me. What produced it? Anybody know? Yes. Yes. Britain had no history. And there were fundamental elements of their culture that were being left by the wayside. It was unraveling. And so they needed a history. So you know what they did? They created one. All right. Now, I will admit that even if Judaism was prone to creating a legend, the cultural catalyst for a legend would not have produced a legend within Judaism that looks like this. You see, what did they desire? What did Jews desire most of all? First century early Palestinian. To be free of who? Okay, and they had someone that they believed was coming to do this. Who was that? The Messiah. Okay, so if you're going to have a legend that's created, what's that Messiah going to look like? A conquering one. He's going to pick up the sword. He's going to wield it. Here's the legend that came about. Messiah showed up. Oh, by the way, he claimed to be God. I know that's weird, but he did. And he went toe-to-toe with the Romans. But guess what happened? Here's the legend now that surfaced out of this cultural catalyst. He went up against the Romans, and did he win or lose? Talk to me. What's the legend? If it's a legend, let's be honest, what happened? In the legend, if you're saying this is a legend, what happens in the legend? He goes up against the Romans, and what happens? They kick his butt. They crucify him. Romans win. Come follow this grand Messiah. Yes, he claims to be Yahweh. Yes, he went up against the Romans. He's dead and gone, and we're still under the Roman rule. But come follow this great legend about this extraordinary Messiah. Worship him as God. I'm submitting to you that even if Judaism was prone to legends, it wouldn't look like this. The legend would look radically different. Wrong cultural catalyst. Lastly, and this is so important, and this is what I wish. Well, we'll get to that. So vital. How do you reconcile a legend, the legendary theory, with no time, no catalyst, wrong culture? How do you reconcile this theory, this legendary theory, with the fact that these men are claiming to be giving eyewitness testimony while there are eyewitnesses also still living, both friendly and hostile? Think about that for a moment. If you're claiming to give eyewitness testimony, in other words, look at how John writes it. Look at with me in 1 John 1, 1 through 5. And we're just looking at this as his claim. We're not looking at it as the inspired word of God. This is just his claim. Which we have, what does it say? Heard. Which we have, what does it say? Seen. With whose eyes? This isn't something that was passed down to him now. He's claiming to have what? Seen it himself. It says, which we have, what does he say? Talk to me. I got to get you out of here. Talk to me. Looked at, our hands have what? Talk to me. We have what? Has appeared to who? We proclaim to you what we have what? And what? This is the message we heard from him, and we declare to who? To you. This, they're claiming to be giving you first-hand knowledge. Does that make sense? At this point, here's the problem. You can't say this is legend. What is this? If it's not true, what is this? It's a lie. And how many found a moment ago that the lie theory was not very plausible? How many found that a moment ago? See, when you really look at the evidence, you can't say it was a legend. You have to say that they were either lying or that it was true, because they claim to have seen these things. And not just that, you have eyewitnesses still living. Mark, and this is one of the greatest evidences of Mark's date. There are others for Luke. We can talk about how I believe Luke, and I can give you very convincing evidence that Luke was written within the first 30 years. Mark, I believe, was written even earlier. Everybody agrees that Mark was written before Luke. But Mark even himself says about Simon, who carried Jesus' cross. He says, Alexander and Rufus's dad. What does that tell you? Dude, you're talking about my dad. The audience that he's writing to knew these people. This is, once again, that oral community, but it's an oral community that is in the very recent history of when these events took place. This is the first generation, second generation. You know the parents. You know the children of the people that were in this story. That's, how many think that's remarkable? That's not legend. You don't have enough time for a legend in that. Number two, here's another one. James. I mean, think about it. If the story's starting to become exaggerated, anybody here have an older brother? Some of you maybe already have an older brother who your parents think is the son of God. I don't know. But think about it. James, Jesus' younger brother, when Jesus was alive, he hated Jesus. Matter of fact, the Gospels tell us that James, Jesus' brother, thought Jesus was out of his mind, crazy. And here's the reason. Joseph had died. History tells us that Jesus' father, Joseph, was dead. So do you know who the responsibility fell to provide for mother and rest of siblings? Do you know who it fell to? The oldest son, which would have been who? Jesus. What does Jesus do? Against all his fundamental Jewish culture, what does he do? He abandons that responsibility and duty to his family. And what does he go become? A traveling rabbi, a preacher. Isn't it interesting? Do you understand why James would have hated Jesus? Because then it fell to who? Who was the next in line? Now think about it. There's other elements you have to realize too. When you read James's writings in the New Testament, what does James define true godliness as? Not a religion, but as taking care of who? Widows and orphans. Why? He was an orphan and his mother was a what? A widow. That's how he defines this firsthand. But what I find interesting about the book of James is how he begins it. He titles himself as the servant of the Lord Jesus Christ. James refers to him as creator, savior. How do you go from younger brother who hates his guts to after, follow with me, after the resurrection, it's becoming exaggerated and legendary to now you believing it too? How do you do that? If it's a legend, how does that happen? I would think if anybody's going to say, you know what, he wasn't really healing the sick, he helped the sick. If anybody's going to say that, who would it be? It's going to be his younger brother, James. They got history. Well, what do you think it was like to grow up with Jesus as your older brother? Who stole the cookies from the cookie jar? I guess it wasn't Jesus. Why can't you be more like your older brother? Oh, I forgot. I mean, think about it. What must it have been like? There's going to be history. There's going to be issues. And James, instead of being the greatest enemy of the Jesus legend, becomes the greatest believer of it. If you're not a believer in Jesus tonight, if you're not a follower of Jesus, not a believer, if you're not a follower of Jesus, I don't want to force this on you by any means. I just want you to consider it. You got to at least come up with a decent, naturalistic explanation for why these things happened like this. Just to say it's a legend, you don't have the evidence to back that up. I know that the story of Jesus contains supernatural events. And I know that produces problems for the naturalistic worldview. Because the naturalistic worldview denies the existence of anything supernatural, anything miraculous. But here's the real, this is what you got to chew on. Light. Can science explain light? Which is it, particle or wave? Yes. And even that's not the right answer. Because it's neither in both. Do you understand what that? Well, they're like, ah. Up until recently, we thought that nothing traveled faster than the speed of light. Now we know that's different. That's wrong. And 1987? Oh, Google the date. It doesn't matter. That part's so insignificant. Entangled electrons. How do we know anything about entangled electrons? Anybody know anything about those? Yeah, entangled electrons. So incredible! Can I bore you for a moment? So egghead. It's so boring. But it's so incredible! Entangled electrons. The electrons are wrapped around an atom. Okay, you unentangle them, okay, and you separate them. This is so wild. You can separate them by even light years. Okay, that's a lot of distance, right? You can separate. And this is what science is discovering. You come over here and you do something to this one, and you are simultaneously, while you're over here doing it to this one, even though it's light years away, simultaneously doing it to that one. You know what science has to do to that? Now let's be honest. All that these things prove is that the world is much larger than what sometimes our known natural laws can explain. How many would agree with that? There may be some things out there we don't know yet. How many would agree with that? There may be something we don't know. All these things prove is that the world is a lot stranger than what sometimes we have assumed. Does that make sense? Here's my contention. Just because the Jesus story has things in it that we don't have natural laws yet that can explain, that shouldn't be enough reason to say it's legend if the legendary theory cannot be supported by hierarchical evidence. Are you with me so far? Are you with me so far? A more scientific approach to these supernatural claims in the Jesus story should be not just to rule them out before we even look at the evidence, but to say there's something here that we can't explain yet and leave it at that. In other words, it seems to me that when all plausible naturalistic explanations become implausible, what's the first, and I know these are big words, but hang with me, what's the first plausible explanation for a naturalistic worldview that we gave tonight? Naturalistic worldview. What would be the first explanation as to why these 11 men told this story? What did we say it was? Not the first option. The first plausible naturalistic explanation. What, it was a lie. What was the second one? It was legend. Those are your naturalistic explanations. But when you look at the evidence, did we find those plausible or implausible? Talk to me. Do we find, looking at the evidence, did we find those two beliefs rational or irrational? Are they going with the evidence or against the evidence? Rational or irrational? Talk to me. So if your naturalistic worldview explanations become themselves implausible and irrational, it seems to me that a more scientific approach would just simply be to say, just like entangled electrons, just like light, just like a million other things we're discovering these days, we just might not know everything. How many would say that's at least a valid option? We just aren't, we don't know it yet. And so you don't have to unplug your brain to believe in these things. There is evidence that's tending in that direction. And I want to submit to you, we don't have time to go into this, but when you take the 9 historical academic standards that every, oh, we'll close with this, maybe. What time is it? It's your fault for inviting someone who has ADD. Wait. When you look at the 9 tests that scholars put historical documents through to determine whether they're legend or historically reliable documents, in all 9 tests, except for 1, the Gospels come through with flying colors above all other known historical documents. What's the 1 test they fail on? The supernatural part. The supernatural part. And that's what you have to wrestle with. That's what you have to wrestle with. All the other... I know it's difficult to believe in it. For me, it's more difficult to believe they were lying. How many were there? How many find that difficult? It's also more difficult to believe that it was a legend. How many found that difficult tonight? So how do you explain it? And some people say, well, Herb, wait a second. Couldn't the stories have been morphed later on? The disciples wrote it, but as they, couldn't they have become legend over time? Here's the deal. No. And I'll tell you why. When the church rose to power in the 4th century and started killing people over this story, first of all, this story was first written not when the world church was, or not when the Christian church was in power wielding the sword. It was when it was being persecuted. Does that make sense? And our early copies of these documents match the ones later. Here's what happened in the 4th century. We didn't change the synoptic gospels. We translated them into a language that nobody knew how to speak so that nobody could read the 4 gospels. What language was that? Latin. And it wasn't until much later that people began to read it for themselves and things began to unravel for that politically driven non-Jesus looking like religion. That's probably the nicest way to say it. Told you I got issues with Christianity. Man, there's so much we can talk about. Let's close with this. Let's do this. Take your Legends and Lore handout. Flip all the way over to the back. Wolfgang Schadenwalt. This is from Hengel's Studies in the Gospel of Mark, page 102. But Wolfgang Schadenwalt. Anybody know who Wolfgang Schadenwalt is? Do you know that name? Anybody here? He is the world's foremost Homeric scholar. What do we mean by that? Homeric scholar. What do we mean by that? Yes! This is so exciting! I'm so used to preaching in churches that don't know what that means! You are a Princeton University student and you're brilliant! Now he said, no, you're not. Oh, I retract. I recant. No, but you're brilliant. Thank you. Wolfgang was invited to the Tübingen University in Germany, the seminary there. And what they wanted to do was conclusively prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that these synoptic gospels, once and for all, are legends rather than historically reliable documents. And this is what Wolfgang, the world's foremost expert in determining this type of decision with historical documents, whether they're legends or historically reliable, this is what he writes. As someone who has acquired some knowledge of literature, it's a very humble way to say it, he says, I am particularly concerned here to note that when we read the synoptic gospels, we cannot be other than, what's the word he uses? Captivated by the what? Experiential vividness with which we are, what does it say? Now, what does he mean by experiential vividness? Because we gotta end. What does it mean by experiential vividness? Yeah, the only way you could have this kind of vivid description of these events is if you actually what? Experienced it. Witnessed it. He said, the conditions of their time stand before us. The nature, landscape of Palestine, the Sea of Galilee, places, the Jordan with its sheer cliff. If only we read the text simply enough, we can imagine Jesus traveling here and there, a situation which we misunderstand if we miss the repeated other way. The most important words are spoken and actions performed on the way, as no more than, what does it say? Literary decorations. Now, what does he mean by that? No more than literary decorations. They don't have a what? Yeah, they don't have an agenda. They're not in there to do, they're just, they're meaningless. They're just there because that's the way they saw it. And it says, I know, and this is so key. This is the world's foremost scholar now. He says, I know of no other area of history writing, biography, or what? If you're looking for reasons to believe they're historically reliable and not legend, here's what the expert says. I find no other area of history writing, biography, or poetry where I encounter so great a wealth of material in such a small place. What's he saying about Matthew, Mark, and Luke there? He's saying if you're looking for evidence to determine they're historical documents and not legendary documents, he says, as the world's foremost expert, I know of no other writings where you find it in greater concentration than you do in these three historical documents. I'm submitting to you the very first option. Though it's difficult, there is a plausible explanation. And that is the reason the disciples were willing to die for this story, the reason they were telling this story, the reason they were willing to watch their wives and children die for this story, is because they genuinely believed it had actually happened. Now, I want to be very clear. Once again, it is about a person, not about a religion. This does not justify, validate, or endorse Christianity. How many are thankful for that? Be honest. Be honest. How many are thankful for that? You see, I think the real reason why the Jesus story is being rejected today isn't based on evidence. It's because people have taken the Jesus story, and what have they done with it? They've used it for political purposes. They've abused people with it. Listen, people out there don't want to have anything to do with Jesus, not because they had some bad experience with a heathen. Are you hearing what I'm saying? It's because they had a bad experience with what? Someone who claimed to be a follower of Jesus. And think about it. When you think of Christian history, the Middle Ages Christian history, think about the atrocities that were committed in the name of Jesus. Wouldn't you too want to do anything you could to discredit this story? Wouldn't you want to also? So their motive, I think, is very, and this is going to be misunderstood by a lot of you, but I actually respect their motive. Because if God is the type of being that Middle Ages Christianity purports Him to be, then you and I too have a moral responsibility, just like Dawkins, just like Harris, just like the late Hitchens, we have just as much a moral responsibility to stand up and oppose that kind of God too. How many would agree with that? If you agree, say yes. But here's the challenge. When you look at the kind of God that person of Jesus actually revealed, it contradicts 99% of the direction Christianity has gone in. The person of Jesus Christ is radically different than the religion that bears His name. And to many people's surprise, the picture of God that Jesus presents is radically different than fundamentalist American Western Christianity paints God to be as well. So please understand, I'm not defending Christianity tonight. Someone says, are you a Christian? I honestly say, no. And some of you guys won't get that. And I respect that. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of stuff in Christianity today that I'm just being honest. It's not my gig. Anybody else ever felt like that? It's not what I want to be associated with. It's not my tribe. I don't believe like that. And one of the biggest reasons I don't believe like that is because I don't see Jesus even teaching that. I see a radically different picture of God in Jesus than I do in modern Christianity. And so I have to distance myself from that. And say, I want to be a follower of that, but not that. Hopefully that makes sense. All right, I don't know what time it is. What time is it? 8:09? Oh, I'm 10 minutes fast. 8 o'clock on the dot. Man, I think that's a first. In over a decade, that's the first time we've ended on time. Feel yourself privileged. Okay, let's open up for questions. Just a quick, few quick questions, if there are any. We can talk about Synoptic Gospels. We can talk about Gnostic Gospels. We can talk about Greek-Roman myth borrowing that sometimes is accused of. We can talk about anything you want to. What do you want to talk about? Yes. Wonderful. Not other gospels that the Catholic Church uses, other Old Testament books that the Catholic Church uses. And once again, and I love the question. Yes, she's asking about the Apocrypha, I think is what you're referring to, which is an old, why are there different ones? And really that's an Old Testament Reformation question. Up until the Reformation, everybody believed that they were good and wholesome, but they weren't reliable for doctrine. Everybody believed that. Now, Luther took a hard stance and said, no, not part of the script. So the Catholic Church took the opposite stance. No, they are part of it. And that's, once again, that would be a question that fits more in a presentation of defending the Protestant Bible as it stands. And remember, I began tonight with saying this is not an apologetic for a book. It's an apologetic for a person. So the question, which I think is very relevant, very similar and very relevant, is why the Synoptic Gospels, why the canonical Gospels, and not the Gnostic Gospels? Anybody ever wondered that? I mean, why were those excluded? That's the same question, but now we're talking Jesus story now. So why the Gnostic Gospels? What do you know about the Gnostic Gospels? Anybody know anything about them? No. No. They were influenced. I mean, Jews became influenced by Gnosticism. But early Gnostic, first of all, the only way you can be saved if you're Gnostic is if you become a man. Are you aware of that? Are you? Go read the Gospel of Thomas tonight. Homework. Go read the Gospel. Get down to the very end. And Peter says, what about Mary? And Jesus says, I will make her man so she can be saved. That's a neat gospel. I like it. No, I don't, really. I was raised by a single mom who would slap me if I actually said that. Here's what we have to realize with the Gnostic Gospels. And first of all of these Gnostic Gospels, there's nothing new in them. Okay? There's nothing new in them. All of the early church fathers knew about their existence, read them, critiqued them, addressed them. Our earliest version of the canon we have from the 2nd century. There's a dude by the name of Marcion who actually had a deep hatred in the 2nd century for Jews. And so he created his own Bible, much like Thomas Jefferson, but for different reasons. He created his own Bible where he began to cut out anything that was Jewish. He threw out the entire Old Testament, and anything that even referenced Judaism in the New Testament, he cut out. And so now you got a crisis in 2nd century Christianity. What do they have to do? If you've got this dude walking around saying, this book you can use and this book's not valid, what does the church have to do? Well, they have to establish a canon. But notice, what was the agenda for establishing the canon? To gain political power and control of the masses? Or to keep anti-Semitism and all of that from creeping into Christianity? What was their motive, first or second? Second. Okay, so you've got that dynamic you have to realize. Here's the other issue you've got to realize. All of these Gnostic Gospels come from 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries. All the canonical writings, all the New Testament writings, we have from within the first 70 years of the historical events. First, they're all first century. Here's the other thing you have to realize. All the Gnostic Gospels, remember the oral tradition we talked about? How many remember us talking about that? All of those Gnostic Gospels were written by authors that were outside of that oral tradition, outside of the community, outside of the network. All of the canonical documents that we have were all written within that oral tradition, within that framework. And I encourage you, go read the Gnostic Gospels. Just go read them. Read them right alongside with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And you'll find that these things are not historically reliable documents at all. They do. You've got existential. You've got realms and different existences, and everything's about secret knowledge. And Jesus comes into. He's the self-evident one, but he has to be brought into evidence. And I don't understand how he can be brought into evidence. It has to be brought into evidence if he's self-evident. It seems like he'd do it on his own. But you've got all this stuff in the Gnostic Gospels that's just all just weird. Just weird stuff. When I gave you an example of one of them. Women, good luck with that. But I want to encourage you, don't just buy hook, line, and sinker what you're hearing on the History Channel. Go do the research. Go look at them. Go read what the early church fathers said about them. This is nothing to, I know the Nag Hammadi Library is an archaeological discovery that is new to us. But what they discovered was just the stuff that was well known to 1st, 2nd century Christianity. And it's nothing new. This has been there. The Da Vinci Code, that whole claim that the 4th century was when they came up with the hogwash. Just a lie. Take a freshman religion course in a secular college and you'll find that wasn't even what that council was about. The canon was already established long before that council, not in 4th century, but in the 3rd century. The 4th century was something totally different. The Gospels were already established long before because of Marcion, not because of any political agenda that the church... I want to say very clearly, I am apolitical. I do not believe the church should have ever gotten... Anybody here feel like Christianity is too political these days? Anybody feel like that? You know, I agree with you that the Christian movement abandoned the teachings of Jesus, laid down the cross, and picked up the sword. I agree with that. But it was through putting away the canonical writings, hiding them in Latin rather than changing them. If they would have paid attention to what they were saying, even today when you go back and look at the canonical writings, it contradicts what was happening in the 4th century. Any other questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something someone raised recently. Herb, how do we know? Because you've got Muslims today that are willing to die for their cause. And it sounds like tonight you said that one of the ways we know the Jesus story is true is that these men were willing to die for it. No, I'm not saying because it's true. What I'm saying is that's one of the evidences we have that it's historically reliable. Nobody's accusing Muhammad of being a legend or a myth. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, it's the evidence that they believed what they were saying was true. Now what you've got to do is look at both of these things that were taught. What did Muhammad teach about Allah? What did Jesus teach? The non-violent Jesus teach about a radically other-centered, self-sacrificial God. What did He teach? And ask yourself, which one has the ring of truth for you? Which one do you hear whispering to you saying, this is truth, walk in it? I want to submit to you that if the story of Jesus is true, sell out. It is the most incredible story. Don't buy Christianity's version of it. Go back and read it yourself. It is the most beautiful picture of a divine being. You not only get the existence of a God, you get a significant clue as to what kind of a person that God is. People say, Herb, can you prove the existence of God? No. No, but I can also... find enough evidence to believe in Jesus. And here's the deal. Do I believe in Jesus because I can prove the Bible, because I believe in the Bible? No. I give the Bible, some say, in my life because I'm a follower of Jesus. Does that make sense? The difference between the two? I don't believe in Jesus because I believe in God. I believe in God because I see plausible evidence for believing in Jesus. And if I can believe in Jesus, remember they were called Christians. What was at the center? And I'm not talking about now how that term's used. So in the original first century, they weren't called scripturans or Bibleans. They were called Christians. What was at the center, what defined them, was they were following this person named Jesus. So again, it's not about a religion by any means. It's about a person. And if you're not a follower of Jesus tonight, I just want to encourage you just to take an open-minded look at what kind of God Jesus portrayed the God of this universe to be. I think there's evidence to believe it. Conclusive, beyond a shadow of a doubt? No, not for anything. But neither is the naturalistic worldview. Think about it. Can you prove by scientific means that nothing supernatural ever happens? Can you prove that? Can you prove that? Do you have enough evidence to conclusively prove there's no exceptions ever to natural laws? Can you prove that? No, it's a philosophy. It's a theory. It's an idea. But you can't prove it. Same with the story of Jesus. You can't prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. But... let me ask you, which one do you think is more plausible this evening? That it was a legend? How many looked at the evidence and saw, it's just hard to believe it's legend? How many would at least go that far? It's hard to believe that it's a legend. How about it's a lie? How many find it really hard to believe it's a lie? And if these dudes are claiming to be saying they saw it, that's not legend, that's lie. And the third one, and I know it's difficult because of our Christian history and because of our modern culture to believe that the story is actually true, I think it's less difficult to believe that than it is the other two options. Once again, just as surely as anything else happened in history, I think the story of Jesus truly did happen. Do we have a photographed image of it? No. But do we have enough of what Jesus was about to get the flavor of what he was about? Yeah, we can get a pretty good idea. And if you that picture of God is radically different. Any other questions? Got to let you go soon. Let me say this. You guys could have been anywhere on a Friday night in Princeton. You're in university. You could have been doing anything tonight. And instead, you chose to sit in hard wooden seats and listen to some West Virginian give you reasons for why he's a follower of Jesus. So I just want to commend you for that. Thank you for choosing to spend this evening with me. I commend you for that. I just think there's something precious going on. I love you guys. Thanks for coming tonight. We will see you tomorrow.